not music. It's not noise. It's textured sound. That's what that is. And talking of textured individuals, he's back. George Filer, Major Filer, as creator, the founder, the chief cook and bottle washer, editor-in-chief of Filer's Files. Major George Filer, retired U.S. Air Force, one of the truly wonderful people in the field of ufology, is back with us tonight. He was supposed to be here last night, but we had some juggling to do, and he was kind enough to accommodate my quirks, and he is here tonight. Hello, Major George. Welcome back.
Hello, Jeff. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. Glad to be here. How was your holiday season?
We had great holidays.
How's
we're freezing right now.
Say,
in
is it, what, about 0 degrees there?
Something like that.
Yeah, I've heard.
Or seven or something, yeah.
Well, it might as well be zero.
What the hell? -6 in Chicago. It's bad all over. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the new earth, as they say. So, all right. What's new with you? We have a special guest you're going to bring on in a few minutes, I guess. But
right, he's going to talk about the Roswell situation. He knew about it essentially before anyone else.
before Stanton?
Right.
Very interesting. Is this a friend of yours for a long time?
Yes, yes.
And, nice.
He'll be wonderful to talk to in a few minutes. I'm sure the
very good
people will be interested to hear what he has to say.
Do look at the center column at Rents, all of you. You'll see George's most current three issues of Filer's Files, including number one. Every year I see number one, and a few weeks later it's number 20. A couple
right.
weeks after that it's number 40. And it just goes so darn fast. So we have 51, 52, and number one up there for you to look at. And if you'd like a free, no cost, no obligation subscription to Filer's Files, all you have to do is write to George and ask him, and you'll get these every week in your electronic mailbox. Just write to George at Major Star, M-A-J-O-R, Major Star, and he is, at Verizon.net. Okay, well, let's just go ahead, and if there's anything in any of these three issues we should look at quickly, let's do so, and then we'll bring your friend on, and we'll get into Roswell.
Well, it happens that, as you probably know, that I had briefed generals all through my career in the Air Force, and General Nathan Twining was one of the greatest Air Force commanders and ended up as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about him is that he said, this are something real and not fictitious. And he is the commander of Air Materiel Command, had his people look into the subject of flying this. And the top intelligence people, the top engineers in the Air Force and so on, studied the whole situation. And there's a good chance they actually had
a real study.
Craft to look at, but they don't say that. But in any case, their best technology personnel in the Air Force said these are real.
Sure.
And that's, and they're not man-made aircraft to their knowledge. It's not a natural phenomena. It's not, you know, meteors. It's not balloons. They climb and do maneuverability, particularly in roll and in action, and they have great capability. And we can go into all the details, but they're metallic and light-reflecting surface. And they're wonderful technology, and they're not something that we have. And the Air Force at that time started Project Blue Book and, you know, investigated them in detail. And I'm kind of carrying on from that interesting memo that General Twining had given to the
Yeah, it's in the first edition. It's in Filer's Files number 1 of the year 2015. The memo is not very long, but let me just read it. George just synopsized it for us. I'll just read it. To Commanding General Army Air Forces. Remember, it wasn't the U.S. Air Force back then. It was still the Army Air Force. Washington 25, D.C. Attention, Brigadier General George, Shulgin?
Yeah. He was head of intelligence at that time.
Number one, there are 5 points here. As requested by AC-AS-2, there is presented below the condensed opinion of this command, meaning General Twining, concerning the so-called flying discs. This opinion is based, now this is a top guy in the Air Force, all right? This opinion is based on interrogation report data furnished by ACAS-2 and preliminary studied by personnel of T-2 and Aircraft Laboratory Engineering Division T-3. This opinion was arrived at in a conference between personnel from the Air Institute of Technology, Intelligence, T-2, Office of Chief of Engineering Division, and the Aircraft Power Plant and Propeller Laboratories of Engineering Division T-3. It is the opinion that the phenomenon reported is something real and not visionary or fictitious. There are objects, probably approximately the shape of a disc, of such appreciable size as to appear to be as large as a man-made aircraft. And there is the possibility that some of the incidents may be caused by natural phenomena, such as meteors. But when General Twining talks, you listen. And we've had so many wonderful features in Filer's Files, thanks to George, that present these absolutely brilliant leaders in their fields telling it straight. It goes on. The memo goes on from there. And it's very interesting. And you should all read it. It's in issue number 1. You can see it in the center column of my website, or just go to George's and take a look.
The point is, there is documents that have been released to the public that shows that these objects, in fact, are real, and that the 2,000 reports we've been getting over the summer, and lesser now, but over 1,000 even now, are something that is real and not fictitious, and the military is well aware of it, and the government may not want to talk about it because there's not a lot they can do about it.
There's nothing they can do about it.
Right.
So, okay, let's bring on your friend,
okay,
if you'd like.
This is Bruce Pearson, and Bruce has a story to tell about his knowledge of the Roswell incident that occurred in 1947, and I think you might all want to listen to hear what he has to say.
Well, we certainly do, and we will. Hello, Bruce. Welcome to the program.
Jeff, it's perhaps you don't recall me, but I had the honor of being on with you about 10 years ago, somewhat less than that, perhaps now, with Brian Vike, when I told about went public with Brian on the Vike Report about my observation, which was a widely viewed sighting over 2 nights over Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico.
I remember this.
Well, it's certainly an honor. Happy New Year
back
to you. And it's an honor to once again be on a show with, and I've been in broadcast journalism and documentaries and investigative, as well as a lot of other things in media, for going on 40 years now. And I want to tell you that I think you are by far the best investigative journalist out there, and I don't say that in a patronizing way. I just truly respect your credibility, your integrity, and the way you handle your show. I followed it for years. I listen every night, and I want to thank you for having me back, and I certainly also think that, Major Filer's incident down at at McGuire and Fort Dix is, in my mind, one of the most amazing events in UFO history, and it's never gotten, you know, the type of exposure that it should.
No, the notoriety factor has been very low on that, and George is a very humble man. He doesn't run around trying to push his opinions and observations and knowledge in people's faces. That needs to be exposed. We should do that more, George.
I think so. It's soon. Remarkable, that story, here in the metropolitan area, to have that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
On the runway. Well, but that's a different issue, certainly.
Well, that's okay. Today. We'll get into that, and I'll make sure that George will go through the whole thing again. Tell us, Bruce, what is it about Roswell that got you involved with all that?
Well,
and when did it happen?
You know, truly, I've had a blessed career. I have every so often, it seems like, bumped into something that kind of connected the dots. And it's almost a synchronicity thing over the last 30 or 35 years. But the beginnings of it, I grew up here in New Jersey and went to Eastern New Mexico University. And the reason I went out there, it was a very hands-on program in broadcasting, the only Channel 3 PBS affiliate, a very state-of-the-art television station.
Uh-huh.
And worked part-time radio as well as in news. I was offered a job back in early on in my college days.
Back when you could still actually get in the business and get a job. Now, everybody wants it. When I was a news director, one of the last jobs I had, just as an aside, I honestly felt that I could have virtually the entire staff pay me to work in television news. The drive to get in front of the camera was that strong for these
kids.
Oh,
absolutely. Yeah, it certainly... And you and I could talk about this offline, but I mean, you turn out tens of thousands of students that want to get in the business anymore. And even though there's a lot more, you know, channels out there and a lot more content being produced, the industry's changed so dramatically. There's no money in any of it. So, people are, you know, it's the old, unfortunately, the radio DJ syndrome. I'll do it for free for the notoriety to tell my friends I'm on the radio. So, but in any event, I was offered, I think because they couldn't get anybody else to do it for the money they're paying. I actually worked as a weekend anchor, the evening anchor at this is a little CBS affiliate there in Roswell. So I'd hop in my car
right in Roswell.
Yeah.
That's fun. That's fun.
But and it was, you know, it was 96 miles from Port Talis down to Roswell, down 40. And so, you know, I think they were paying me all of close to $8 an hour at that time, and you know, I'd run 96 miles down there and work for a four-hour shift, come in 2 hours early, 2.5 hours early, go through everything, get prepped, and go on the air from 10 to 10:30, I think was the slot, do some post stuff with them and button everything up, and I'd run out to the Phillips 66 trucks plaza there, have the blue plate special, and then hammer back up to Clovis, New Mexico, because I worked the overnight at KMTY.
Wow.
And yeah, till 6 in the morning. So I went from 1 till 6. But, you know, when you're young, you do these things.
I did it once. I drove 90, it was 93 or 94 miles, you know, each way to anchor the weekend news at a CBS affiliate. Same kind of story. That weird.
Sounds like neither one of us made any money. But I was, it was quite an honor at that age, you know, 21, 22 years old.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And, it was basically a ploy. They said, you know, we got the new blood and all this. It was just an advertising shtick. But it was good for me because I was anchoring a couple newscasts at Channel 3. And, you know, the PBS format was a different, you know, we filled in with press releases and so forth. Yeah. So it was a whole different feel at that time. But the gist of the story, which really got me into investigative journalism, was the events that took place there. I'm sitting there having my, you know, my meatloaf and mashed potatoes, jamming it down, getting ready to go back to work overnight. And this tall cowboy comes up. Now, this is a huge truck plaza. I mean, there's probably 200 or 300 trucks in there at any given time. They got truck wash and repair bays and a hotel and a bar and restaurant and so on. Mm-hmm. It's basically a Disneyland for trucks. And this guy comes up to me and he goes, "Hey, you're the guy from the news, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, and I'll never forget this. This was quite an interesting conversation. He said, well, how come you people never do any stories about the flying saucer? And he didn't call it a UFO then. The flying saucer that crashed out here after the war. And, you know, being from New Jersey, my cynical self, I'm going, ah, geez, I got a drunk cowboy here. You got to watch what I say. And I said, flying saucer? He goes, yeah, the one that crashed after the war out here. And they told everybody, and then they shut us all up. And I said,
they shut us all up, he said.
Yep. And I said, well, I never heard anything about that, and I'm up in Portales. I said, what do you mean they shut you all up? He said, well, they sent out press releases, was in the paper, and all the, you know, the radio station down here had it and so forth, and had it on the air. And then a day or two later, they told everybody it was a weather balloon and told everybody to shut up. And I said, what do you mean they told everybody? They told everybody to shut up? He said, look, and I could tell this guy had a short fuse. He said, look, Sonny, this was the end of the war, and everybody in Roswell either worked for Walker Army Air Base or, or their family did, or somebody they knew did.
Yeah.
And if you weren't in the dairy business, then you worked at the air base. And, you know, we had just won the war. This was these are the guys that had the nuclear weapons, he said. And, you know, we were fighting the commies then. And I'll never forget he worded it that way. And he said, if they told you to shut up, you shut up. And he said, pretty much the word got around very quickly. And they put out anybody, you know, the word to anybody. I said, well, don't know what to tell you. I never heard about this. He said, well, it's well known around here. So he said, how about doing a story on it? I said, well, I don't think you understand. I'm pretty low on the food chain here. I don't make those decisions.
This is fascinating.
Said,
that this guy would come up
and
I'm just amazed.
Out of the blue.
Yeah.
Well, he saw, yeah, I guess he, you know, he saw me on the news.
For sure.
Or something. And I said, well, you know, how do you substantiate this? He said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. He said, if I get people that'll talk to you on the record, he said, will you do a story on it? I said, well, I can't promise that. I don't have, you know, I don't have enough juice to make those decisions, but I'll certainly try to follow up with you. He said, okay. He said, that's all I wanted to hear. He said, I'll be in touch. And he walked away. Didn't give me his name. But, he, you know, he's wearing a sport coat, like a shooting gun. He was well-dressed. I mean, he had a nice pair of pressed jeans on. Tall guy. He's got to be 6.5 feet tall. And he's wearing a cowboy hat, you know, but dressed very nice. And he just turned around and walked away. I said, okay, well, I'll never hear from that guy again. I went about my business. So, honest to God, about a month and a half later, I'm same situation, probably within 10 minutes of the same time, I did the same routine. It was a Saturday night that time. The first time was a Friday night. I'm sitting there, and bang, a yellow lined tablet falls in front of me on the counter there. I'm sitting there at the counter eating. And I look up.
Like a yellow legal pad.
Yeah, the yellow legal pad. It's got writing on it. And I look up. It's the same bloody guy. And I go, oh man, now what? And I probably look like deer in the headlights because I never suspected that. I figured it was the last time I hear from this guy. He goes, okay, there's 11 people that will talk to you on camera. There's their phone numbers and addresses. They'll all talk to you. Now you hold up your end of the bargain.
Wow.
So I went, hebbity, 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 hebbity. And I said, look, I said, that's great. I said, but I have to talk. I'll talk to the news editor down here, and I'll talk to my boss up at Channel 3, and I'll see what I can do. I said, but I promise you this, I will follow up with these people. So he said, okay. I said, well, how do I get a hold of you? So he goes, I'll get back in touch with you. I'll find out if you're doing what you said. And it was a little weird, but I don't know. The guy just never gave me his name and phone number or anything else. He seemed, you know, he says, I really don't want to get involved in it directly, he said, but the story needs to be told. It's been long enough. It was the way he worded it. So he shook my hand, and he says, I wish you good luck on it. Just we'll keep in touch.
What a very interesting thing. What year was this?
This was 1977, because I had been there for about a year or so before I got this job. So I went back to the station, and I talked to some people that were there, some of the professors and the guys that I worked with over at the station, Larry Bradshaw, who's probably retired now. He went up to Dyess Air Force Base. He was a spokesman at Dyess, and he used to anchor the evening news up there. Great guy, wonderful guy. Gary Kishi, who was a news director up there and one of the staff people, and then I spoke to Dwayne Ryan. And by the way, they just had their 40th anniversary at KNW, and I wasn't able to get out there for it, but Dwayne's still there. And I don't know if he'll ever retire, but a great mentor and a great broadcaster and journalist. And anyway, so he said, well, you know, Bruce, he goes, oh, flying saucer? I said, you know, Mr. Ryan, I don't know what to tell you, but that's what the man said. And I got mm-hmm. the names and phone number. He said, well, why don't you go ahead and follow up on it? And he said, we really don't have, you know, back in those days, Jeff, is I think most of the people our age know, you know, you couldn't pay people to do a documentary. If it wasn't Nova, there wasn't anything on, really.
That's right.
And it wasn't a phenomenon that anybody was interested in. So there was no budgets for anything. So, you know, we were shooting film back then, and we had the first DNG camera in the state of New Mexico, an old Sony 1610, and it was all, our stringers were shooting on high-8 film and 16 millimeter, so it was not a very progressive technical era that I started in. And he said, well, we really don't have any budget to do any documentaries, but he said, see what you can find out and keep me posted. So I went back down to Roswell during the day. And, you know, back in those days, making a long-distance call was a big deal because you had to walk around with a pocket full of change. So I went down there and just went into the lobby of a hotel down there with a payphone and started calling these people. And I did get a hold, and I ended up speaking to 8 or 10 of the people that ended up being key people as time went on. Frankie Rowe I spoke to.
Oh, yeah.
I spoke to Glenn Dennis, and he was pretty interesting, telling me about, well, yeah, first they call me and want to know how many kid caskets we have. He said, well, how many do you think we keep in stock here? You know, it's not a warehouse. He said, we don't get a lot of, you know, babies and little kids that we bury. He said, I don't know. They called from the base a couple hours later and said, how long would a body last in formaldehyde if it wasn't in ice? And, you know, it was interesting. And I was like, man, there's got to be something to this. These people are. And then when, you know, the air police guy stood there with his baton, batting it in his hand and saying, you know, people disappear in the desert all the time. And she said, I'm a little kid. I'm ready to have a nervous breakdown. And her dad, you know, had been one of the first responders out there with the fire department. So
we'll keep going, Todd. Go ahead, Bruce.
Oh, no. Yeah, you guys got to take a break.
No, I'm going to go through the break. Go ahead. Todd, we'll just keep going here. Thanks.
Okay.
Go ahead, Bruce.
So anyway, I went through a bunch of them. And at that time, I had the opportunity to go get one of the deals that Channel 3 was. They offered me an engineering position if I would get my first class license.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the middle of making a decision to do that. I had all these notes for meeting with these people, and so I had to go up to Denver and take this test. And they really went, it was the end of the year or the beginning of the new year. In the fiscal year, it started in October, and Dwayne says, well, I don't know what to tell you. He says, you can do some audio interviews and stuff, but I really don't have any money in the budget for shooting film. So I ended up going up to Denver and working on this associate's degree in broadcast engineering, and just couldn't, because of my circumstances as a student, follow up on it. But, you know, I guess it was about a year or two later that Kevin Randall or I don't know, Schmidt or Randall, or I know that Stanton made his connections through Jesse Marcel down there, you know, sitting in an airport in Louisiana or whatever happened, where he came into the thing,
right.
and they picked up the ball and went forward from there. But you know, if it means anything, you know, I could in a very strange way corroborate, which has been corroborated many times on camera and stuff, but that this was what was going on. One of the interesting things, Jeff, that I came up with, I spoke to a gentleman, and I need to go through my notes if I can find them.
Do you still have that yellow legal pad?
You know, here's the problem. I had, and it's funny, because this last summer, when, I forget which, about 2 years ago when we had it was a tropical storm. The power went out. My backup generator didn't come on. I had like 2 feet of water in my basement, and I had a footlocker with all these notes and stuff in it, and a lot of it got destroyed. It was still there, but it was the pages were all stuck together. So I still had that yellow pad. I tried to peel the pages apart. You know how they get all wet and stuck together. Some of my notes I kept that I was able to read like a couple pages on. But most of them were destroyed. It wasn't like a big storm, but we had a lot of rain, and I ended up I was away actually on a trip, doing a shoot, and, actually, my wife was away too, so there wasn't anybody in the house, and I ended up with a real mess. I had a lot of damage, but it flooded out that footlocker that had a lot of the important keepsakes in it. But here's an interesting story, and this was, I think, one of the most compelling things. And I've never heard this guy interviewed. There was a guy who was in his 50s, and I can dig up his name, but he was working at the AM station there, and he was in high school. And the station manager would let him come in. He wasn't working on the air or anything, but he was interested in radio. So he would come in and clean the studios and help out and organize tapes and records and that stuff and clean up the teletype room, he told me. So the afternoon when they clamped down on everything, he was in there cleaning. He said he was in there cleaning in the big studio, and it was late in the afternoon, and these two guys come in. His car pulls up, and he said, they didn't know I was in there because the guy on the air was, you know, in the booth, and the station manager was in his office, but they didn't know I was in the back studio cleaning up. So he said they come through, and he said, I knew something was weird. And it's funny to hear this guy tell a story. He said, I knew these guys were screwballs because it's July, end of July in New Mexico, and they're wearing these black wool trench coats, and they're driving around in a black car, and obviously there was no air conditioning. He said, you know, you knew these guys stuck out like a sore thumb. They must have been roasted in these black trench coats in the middle of summer in New Mexico. So they come in the studio, and they go in to the station owner's office, and he said they were there for about an hour just screaming at this guy and threatening him, and he went in great detail. He said, I'll never forget this conversation about how you're not going to, no more discussions about this incident will go on the air from here. If you do, you're not only going to lose your license, you're going to lose your station, and you may disappear. And,
wow.
He said it was so over the top threatening. It was like watching a mob movie because they were basically threatening this guy's life.
And this, what year was this approximately?
No, this was 47.
Okay.
This was right after the event happened.
They didn't waste time, boy. They came down on this.
No,
like
he said they came in like they just blasted in. They set this guy down.
Yeah.
And for 45 minutes, they read him the riot act. And he said, I was just listening, holding my breath. But he said what happened once they left was even more scary. And he said this is the first time I've really ever talked to anybody about this, because this guy, he grabbed me by the shirt and pulled me into the office, and he screamed at me for an hour. He literally yelled, he said, do you understand? You can't ever discuss this with your parents or your friends or your relatives or anybody. You heard what they said. They will kill us all. We will all die. Do you understand? I'm being serious. And he said, I'm in high school, you know, and I think I'm a heavy duty guy. And this guy's got me crying. He said, he's got me so scared that I'm shaking like a leaf. He put the fear of God in me for an hour. And he said, you don't understand. If you ever discuss this, even with your mom and dad, there's a chance we'll all be killed. This is not funny. I don't know what to tell you. This is real. I'm not kidding. I'm not. And this guy went on. And I mean, I tell you, it was pretty shocking to hear this guy tell this story. I wish I had a cassette recorder at that time and had recorded the interview with this fellow. And he was in his 50s. And he said, to this day, I've never been so frightened in my life. Not as much from listen to those guys threatening him, but from the station manager being so scared that he was screaming at me. His voice was trembling. He said, they're going to kill us all. He said, I don't know what's going on here, but they're going to kill us all. You can't talk about this. Don't ever. And, you know, I remember having an hour ride home or hour and a half ride home after that going, geez, you know, how do you assimilate that? This is the era, you know, Vietnam and people questioning stuff, but it wasn't like today where you realize this underhanded viciousness.
Well, they kill people.
Exactly.
We know it. I mean, it happens all the time.
And you know what happened to me? I mean, I think it's just an ironic turn that sighting over Cannon, which, you know, I actually have dug up some more information subsequent to when I was on your show, and then, you know, a couple nights later, the same kind of scenario, the same nonsense at 3 o'clock in the morning with some clown, you know, telling me bullets are cheap, people have accidents all the time. I said, what are you, watching a Guy Ritchie movie here? What are you kidding me? Tell me who you are. Give me a reason not to say anything. And I was in the reserves. I said, I'll tell me it's national security and I'll shut up. But don't call me in the middle of the night and threaten me like some gangster. I mean, that's not how it's done. So, you know, here 25 years later, when I finally said I ought to get it on the record with Brian, and we agreed that we should do it, and you were nice enough to let me go on the air, and then I got some screwball, you know, calling me in the middle of the night.
In other words, after you were on the program here,
yes,
you were threatened and hassled again.
Two nights later, on a private cell phone, I carried a business cell phone back in those days, and a private cell phone. Nobody but my family had that number.
Yeah.
And I had been sleeping in a guest room because I had to get up real early in the morning, plus I was coughing my lungs out. And so my wife didn't hear the call. Phone rings. I'm like, geez, it's, you know, is it my mom, my family members, mm-hmm. is there an emergency?
Mm-hmm.
And it's some guy on the phone saying, Mr. Pearson, we wanted to talk to you about your radio interview, meaning your show.
Yeah.
I go, who is this? And why are you calling me 3 in the morning? And how'd you get this number? And, you know, that this went on and it escalated to the point where I was like, it was incredible. He said, well, you don't need to know that, but we, and he kept using plural we, we just think that you should cease discussing this in public. And I said, well, who are you and why and, you know, what's going on here? And it just got more strident as the conversation went on, and I got more angry. And, Jeff, there's so much more to that story after the fact, because I finally told the guy, I said, look, if you are so screwed up that you're going to threaten me and not give me a decent reason that I will abide by, if you tell me who you are and why you're doing this, and don't do it in such a childish manner, and don't threaten me. I don't take threats real well, you know. I mean,
that's amazing. I wish that somehow you would have let me know. If you had wanted to, I would have, you know, rolled the carpet out and you would come right back on. But I wouldn't want to put you in jeopardy. But they listen to this program. We all know that. They listen to every damn thing. But
exactly.
That's really disgusting. Come on.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I told the guy. I said, you know, let me tell you something. You know, my dad was a PT boater in World War II. You know, I went through Desert Shield and Desert Storm. I'm as patriotic as they come. You give me a good reason, and all you have to say, and I told the guy, all you have to say to me right now is I'm with the following government agency. This is a matter of national security. I'm asking you to stand down on this.
And you handled it perfectly. You absolutely handled that perfectly. What did he say?
He said, you don't need to know who we are. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know what? Then I'm just going to take this as a prank phone call. And here's the, Jeff, it got worse. And here's where my ears perked up.
You're still there, George. Don't go away.
Yep. All right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is not
okay.
Directly about Roswell, but I think you know, you never hear, very seldom, and Jeff, you're in a much better position, you never hear people getting overtly threatened. But here's what the guy said to me. He said, well, I said, I think you're just blowing smoke, and I think you're a coward to do this way. And if you're officially doing this, it's even more repugnant to me. This is not how our government works. And I said, I think this is just some kind of sick hoax. And he goes, no, I'll tell you how serious we are and how much we know about you. He said, I know your oldest son just got his Eagle Scout. And he went on. He said, I know your other son's finishing a black belt in Taekwondo. And he went on to tell me three or four things. And Jeff, God is my witness, they were definitely surveilling me. So I don't know what was going on. But why this – here's the big thing about the big picture – why was that incident so bloody important?
Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing.
you know,
I'm thinking the same thing.
Hold on, Bruce.
This is this is very interesting. Why that one, and why not any one of 100 others
that are much more prominent?
No, this got
that.
Highest level attention, obviously.
Absolutely.
And they're listening to you right now.
Good. I hope they are. Enjoy yourselves, boys. Turn up the volume.
Back in just a couple of minutes with George and our special guest, Bruce Pearson. Don't go away. All right, let's get right back to the conversation. George, any comment here before we step into Bruce's narrative again?
Well, obviously we don't know who was calling him. I've had nice conversations with people in the government, and I've had similar calls to what he's had. It may just be someone who's... I don't know, taking on that aspect. Also, there's an indication that a lot of this has been turned over to private enterprise.
I was going to say that the sense I got, Bruce, from what you were saying, was that this was either a rogue or an extra-governmental group. I mean, outside the military even. Something else. I don't want to say MJ-12, but George just put his finger on it. That's what I heard. The possibility that this was something that we really don't even know or have necessarily a name for, a group.
Well, I think there's a rational possibility that this stuff has been put arm's length outside the government, which will allow the old plausible
full deniability. Of course,
absolutely. And let me tell you that it just keeps going on. Because let me give you the follow-up to this thing. So at the end of the conversation, and now let me go back to your earlier point. At the end of the conversation, I said, look, I don't take very lightly to threats. And so if you're not going to, you're on a private phone, you have no right to bother me. I said, you know what? You guys can pound sand. I don't scare too easily. And if you're not man enough to tell me a reason and you're not, you know, honorable enough to do that, I have nothing more to say to you, and I'll do as I see fit. So I hung up on the guy, and here I have to watch what I say because you'll understand why. I used to do a lot of corporate television work, and I worked for quite some time with AT&T. Actually, was there and covered the divestiture public affairs. Press conference when they broke up AT&T.
When they cracked it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, when Charlie Brown made the announcement and so forth. Yeah. Timothy Worth got his way. Anyway, so I called a good friend of mine who had retired. We actually did some shows on toll fraud for long lines and so forth. And I said, hey, can I meet you downtown? This guy lives out here by me. And a very good friend. Combat photographer, Naval Reserve, good, really solid earth guy, and a great guy. And he said, sure. So we had coffee, and I told him what happened. I said, do you know anybody, you know, that you can call and see? Because it all came up with all X's or zeros or something on the phone when the number came in, so I had no idea where the number was coming from. I said, look, you know, it's an invasion of my privacy. I don't like getting threatened. It's a private number. Could you see if you can, you know, call up my phone and see if they could find out where it initiated.
Yeah.
Well, he says, I don't know if I can do that, but unofficially, maybe I can ask around.
Yeah.
So this was on a Tuesday. The next night, I get a call at like 8 o'clock, and it's this fella. And I will not say his name, and you'll understand why. He goes, meet me at 8 o'clock at the town luncheon at tomorrow morning. I said, what's up? I said, what'd you find out? He says, I'm not talking about it on the phone. Just meet me there. All right, so I figured he dug something up. I go down there, I'm sitting there. He comes in through the door, and this is not like this fella. This guy is about as squared away as you can get. Mm-hmm. He's looking around. He comes to the booth. He goes, let's go to the back of the restaurant. I said, all right. He sits down, and this guy is as white as a sheet. He said, now, I'm going to tell you this, and we're not going to have any more discussions about it. I don't know what you're fooling around with here.
Jeez.
But I ask about it. Now, listen to what the man tells me. I asked a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. He came back about an hour later, and I was told that whatever I'm doing, I better get away from this real quickly, or it will be the end of my pension. And he said, I was told no on certain terms. You better stay the hell away from this. So he says, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know who you're messing with, but I'm not losing my pension over this thing. We will never discuss this again, and that's the end of it. Is that clear? I was like, oh, yeah.
Damn.
Sorry, man. I mean, this guy was shaking. He goes, if you think I'm losing my pension over this nonsense, he said, they're threatening me for even asking about it, and I didn't even, you know, and they really ripped the guy
out. He never found out. He just looked into it, and they jumped.
Oh, and he... Yeah, and he got his head cut off, and I said, oh, man.
Well, you'd not see what, now, for you listening out there, I'm sure some of you have already clicked on this, take your pension away. That's the least they could do, but that'll kill you. That'll really destroy your life. They did that to Clark McClelland when they got rid of him from NASA.
NASA, right.
And they took everything away from him.
I'm convinced, Jeff, that this is... in today's environment, the most effective way to get people. And I'll tell you, and let me tell you the end of the story, because it continues to go on.
Well, I'm not answering my phone tonight. All right.
I hope I don't bring you bad karma for the beginning of the year. But so listen to this. We have a place up on Cape Cod, and we go up over the 4th of July. And we're up there for 2 weeks. And I come back that summer. This is a couple months later, and late in the summer, I'm out mowing the lawn, and one of the fellas across the street comes over, and he goes, geez, I've been trying to catch up with you. I said, yeah, what's up, man? He goes, what are you doing? You selling drugs out of your house or something? I have a huge house that we bought as a foreclosure, a mansion. It's beautiful. We shot a couple episodes of The World Turns here and some car commercials, but I'm trying to get rid of it now because it's just, you know, it's just ridiculously stupidly large. But anyway, the long and the short of it is it's a circular driveway out front with the wall in front of it and all that. And they go, what are you talking about? He goes, well, when you were on vacation, he says, I haven't been able to catch up with you. He said, I was around during the day, and he said, every day you were away on vacation, there was a federal car sitting in your driveway for an hour with the motor running, and then they'd leave. I said, what do you mean a federal car? He goes, you know, the Crown Victoria with the little stubby antenna, the windows blacked out, the cheesy hubcaps. I said, well, how do you know it was a federal car? Not, you know, he goes, because it had G11 or G14 plates on it. You know, it said U.S. government. I said, well, what were they doing? He goes, nothing. They were sitting in a car with the air conditioning running and the water draining out of the bottom of it. I said, yeah, and you never saw anybody get out? Nope. And he said, I'd look out, and they'd be there for an hour, and then they'd be gone, but a puddle of water there. Every day you were on vacation, I saw at least once. Same car? He goes, yeah, it looked like the same one. You know, silver gray Crown Vic. I said, and you never saw them get out? He said, nope. He said, it looked like they were just making sure everybody saw they were sitting there in your front, you know, right in front of the house. Right in my driveway. I said, wow, Jesus. I said, you didn't take any pictures or anything? He said, no. He says, I didn't know what they were doing. He said, but, you know, I figured you were smuggling dope or something. I said, come on, man, give me a break. No, I wasn't doing it. So they were on my property. Now, this is after the fact, and I, you know, this was several months later. Well, fast forward to me finishing my career with the Coast Guard Reserve, and my discharge papers all come through, except they come through for some guy from, you know, Topeka or something. So I call him, and I said, hey, I got my retirement, you know, my DD-214, my whole package, but it's some other guy's stuff. Oh, okay. Just hang on to it. It's a paperwork snafu. We'll send it to you. That's 3 years ago. I've called him. I've written him. I went to the VA. What do you think the guy at the VA says? Oh, this is weird. I've been doing this for 20 years. He said, you're not in the system.
Oh,
what do you mean,
geez.
I'm not in the system? Now, it gets better. He says, do you have any documentation? So I come home. I'm a public information officer. I'm a public affairs specialist for them. I bring my enlistment papers, my good conduct, my two re-enlistments. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
sure.
All right. I got pay stubs. I got pictures of me. I've got my commandant's letter.
So you're a PIO in the Coast Guard?
Right.
Okay. All right.
So
we only have about 3 minutes, but I'm fascinating.
Sorry.
No, it's fascinating. And go ahead.
So this
is 3 years ago. You were erased. They did the same thing to you, basically, that they did to Clark McClelland.
Well,
sounds
and Burroughs
so far,
and
all
yeah.
How many, too many to count. This is disgusting me again. Go ahead.
So Sunday, I just met with a congressman to say, I said, look, I want to get this straightened out. I just want to get my 10% discount at Home Depot, you know. Jeff, I'd like to talk to you off the air, and I'm sorry. I appreciate George having me on. You know, I hate to go on so long. But
well, listen, let's do that. George has my number. He'll give it to you, and you can ring me up anytime after 10 a.m. at the office, and I'll be around.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's been an honor to be on, and George, thank you so much. We spent the evening together on New Year's Eve at a mutual friend's event, and it was so nice to see George. He's done such a great job.
He has
a lot of work, and I'm humbled by both of you guys to have me on. And I
very,
hope that the
very kind,
does.
Bruce. Thank you. Good to talk to you again. We
thank
will
you.
Talk. All right.
Thank
stay in touch,
George. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Well, there's a lot of stories out there, and I thought it might be interested in that one.
That's a very good one, very bad one. I don't know where it's going to end up, but it looks like they've done something that is not good to his future. But he's still alive and healthy, so we'll see. I'll talk to him some more. You know much more about it than I do. Who are these people, George? Have they privatized it? Have they contracted it out? Are these just punks and thugs now running and scaring and frightening and intimidating and threatening people? What's going on?
I don't know. Like, well, the technology is worth millions, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody may be protecting
And if they're
technology.
Sitting in his driveway with, well, the Crown Vic is a dead giveaway, but, I mean, government plates, at least they could have put some public plates on. I don't know. I wish I could remember it. I'm going to ask him to tell me that story again. I don't remember much about the Cannon story. You've got it all.
Right. Well, there's a lot going on in this field, and I think it's...
See how George understates everything? Listen to him. You bet there is.
People talk to me all the time who have... You know.
Well, you've earned the trust of the world, basically. All those who are interested in this field, deservedly so, and they do want to talk to you. And I would encourage anyone out there who has a story to tell, get in touch with George. Give him the address of your website, George.
NationalUFOCenter.com is the website. And all of the files are there. We're happy to send it to people. I am getting calls from people who claim to be aliens.
Well, let's get one on. Bring them on. Bring
they
as many on as you
a
like.
Bit, you know, you never know.
No, you don't, and that's why I'm not kidding. Please invite one or two of them on. I'm wide open to anything. So, thank you, Major. And again, George's email address is Major, M-A-J-O-R, star, S-T-A-R, at Verizon.net. You can write to him that way, ask for a subscription free to Filer's Files, or say, I'd like to talk to you, George. Can we talk? Okay. All right, my friend. Thank you for being here, George. That was really good. And talk to you next
You're
month
welcome.
Or sooner. Anytime. Just let me know.
Okay.
Okay, my friend. Good night.
Good night.
All right. Well, there you go. There's a lot going on, and we'll be right back.